we know from animal and cell culture research that estrogen should really benefit the brain, should protect the brain against Alzheimer's disease. But so far, the treatment studies have not really shown long-term benefits. Davina McCall did a documentary a couple of years ago now where she talked about this and what a difference it had made. And what we can see overall is that about half of the women say it really benefited them. But often for short periods of time, and most women don't take it for that long for whatever reason. Sometimes they feel it stops working, or they get a bit spooked because there is slight increased risk for breast cancer, or they just want to give it a go and you know, see how they fare.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast aims to highlight the latest research and trends in health as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today, I'm delighted that we are joined by Professor Eef Hogevorst. Eef is a Professor of Biological Psychology at Loughborough University. Eef, it's wonderful to have you here today. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Not at all. So before we get going into the meat of what we're going to talk about, can you just tell me about biological psychology, Professor of Biological Psychology? What is biological psychology?
Well, I was originally trained in health sciences and I majored in mental health sciences, but my main interest really is in how the body affects the brain and how the brain can affect the body. And so that includes things like physical activity, which is why I'm here, but also diet and hormones.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for outlining that. Much appreciated. Can you then just tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself? What do you do? You know, tell us a little bit about how you've come to this point. It'd be really interesting to hear a bit more about you.
Well, I came here over 20 years ago, and I came to Loughborough because of its expertise in exercise and physical activity. And before that, I worked at Oxford and Cambridge University to look at risk and protective factors for dementia. And one of the things that we found was most protective throughout the lifespan was physical activity. So I thought, well, join the experts here and try to come up with something that could protect people against developing dementia, or once they have dementia, what we could do to improve their memory functions and independence.
So over that period of time, do you feel like you've got closer to fully understanding how we can help people in that area, or is there still a lot to work out?
Well, I've been really fortunate because Loughborough's got really excellent students, and we were able to work with some amazing PhD students, and they've come up with various programs, exercise programs, using resistance bands to help people improve their memories, improve their strength. And in particular, something called self-efficacy, which is where you realize that actually you can do more than you think you can. So, I would say they've had success with that, measurable improvement on memory tests and mood and strength of these exercises. So, yeah, no, definitely.
Made some good progress there. It's always helpful to have a team working with you, isn't it? So we're going to be talking about something mainly today, which is sort of aside, related, but an aside to that. So can you just give us a brief opening statement to whet people's appetite to say why what we're going to talk about today is so important to you and should be to our listeners?
Well, one of the things we discovered very early doors was that the risk for dementia goes up in women in particular. And we weren't quite sure why that was the case. And one of the reasons could be and I've been looking at this since 1988, I'm afraid I still don't have an answer, is women undergo the menopause, so they lose estrogens. And we know from animal and cell culture research that estrogen should really benefit the brain, should protect the brain against Alzheimer's disease. But so far, the treatment studies have not really shown long-term benefits. So they show short-term benefits, but then if people keep on taking it, or if people start taking it when they're over the age of 60, they actually seem to have negative effects. So not entirely sure why that happens.
Just to take us back to that first part then, can you outline what is the menopause, just for people who are listening? How does it present on the outside, and what's happening internally?
So the menopause, you have a finite number of ovaries, and at one point they're just not functional. So the eggs basically helping to produce the estrogens. And estrogens normally help your body in a wide variety of ways, but they can also affect the brain. In the years before the menopause, these estrogens start fluctuating, and that's when we see the majority of complaints like flushes, people can't sleep very well, people have memory problems. And so some people thought, well, maybe that makes people more vulnerable for an increased risk of dementia later on. So because estrogens can affect the brain, can protect the brain, and if that effect falls away, then maybe that lack of estrogens could make women more vulnerable to dementia.
And keeping it lay for myself, how does estrogen have that relationship with dementia? What actually happens, as I say, keeping it as lay as you can be for me?
Yeah, no, it's estrogens, to put it in the simplest way, there was a lady called Barrett Connor in 1998, and she said, the biological plausibility for estrogens to protect the brain is its strongest suit. Now, what that means is that any mechanism implicated in Alzheimer's, because there's loads and loads of research in looking at, for instance, a lack of blood flow through the brain, causing a lack of oxygen, which, of course, the brain needs to function, issues in how the brain works with sugar as it develops Alzheimer's, also the chemicals that allow us to have communication between the brain cells, the neurotransmitters, they're affected in Alzheimer's. There is, Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. There is a buildup of plaques in the brain, but all those mechanisms, estrogens can protect against. So really, by all intents and purposes, they should protect women. And so giving estrogens back to women after the menopause, the hormone replacement therapy, that should help.
And we'll come on to whether it does in a second. But I can imagine from what you've sort of said there that the menopause and what those experiences are like, that's always been the case for people who have the sort of similar biology within them since time began. Or is it a more modern phenomenon, the menopause and how that presents?
I think it's interesting because what menopause means, we can see that in different cultures, is very different. For instance, some research I've read from India, and also some of the work we've done in Indonesia, where women reach a higher status, where they become more important as they go through menopause, and they now can be part of the wise council of the village. For those women, it is actually very positive. It's a positive experience. They talk about the menopause as change, as something that's, you know, positive. Again, you need to be a little bit careful with this sort of anthropological approach, because of course people hear what they want to hear. And of course people speak to people in the way that they think people want them to answer. But what we do know is that some of the hallmarks of menopause, like flushes, the hot flushes people get because of these changes in hormones. So you suddenly get really hot and you can start sweating and your heart starts racing. That occurs in pretty much everybody. About 80% of women have that to a larger or lesser extent, with more or less bother. But other symptoms, like for about half of the women, complain about changes in mood, in memory, brain fog, no longer being able to concentrate. And that can be quite severe. In fact, a third of women going through that transition is thought to want to quit their jobs. There's been some surveys where women say, I can't do this anymore, I'm going to quit my job. And an estimated 14% of women going through this quit their job because they can't function anymore. Because the flushes can also occur at night, so you can't sleep, you can't concentrate when you're at your work. Some people have to wear uniforms, and so it can be quite severe. But the extent to how that is experienced and for how long. For some women it's a couple of months, for some women it's 12 years. So there's a wide, wide variety, and how you interpret that change. For instance, there's some studies finding that Catholic women, for whom it's very important to have many children, in the past had great problems with the menopause going through it.
So there's this interaction between the biology, but also what your position is like within the particular society or family, you know, whether you're working or not working, and all of these interacting factors. Would you say then, if someone says, you know, the menopause is a biological phenomenon, would you not say that's the case?
Well, it's obviously it's triggered by something biological, but the way that people handle it and handle the symptoms is very individual, and is determined by so many things. Your partly biological factors, like your weight. If you drink a lot, if you smoke a lot of stress, those symptoms will be often quite severe. But also your psychological makeup. You know, how you view this change, and whether it's a challenge, whether it's something, you know, that you look forward to, because it comes with a different set of circumstances and a different you in many ways as well, I guess.
So if we move on to the idea of, you know, treatment, do you think that's the right, is that a helpful term? Is that how it's seen as something to aid the individual, normally by, from my, you know, understanding, taking something to change the way that their biology is functioning? Should it actually not be about taking something, but changing the environment around, because ultimately there's nothing wrong with the experiences that they're having?
That's a really good point. I think, again, you know, women need to think about this for themselves and what they want and what they need. It's very important that women drive that agenda themselves. And I think you should start slow, where you look at changing lifestyles. For instance, drinking alcohol, smoking, stress, drinking lots of coffee, not sleeping, all these contribute to severity of flushes, so that interacts with one another. If I'm not sleeping because I'm having flushes, I'll then be drinking lots of coffee during the day, and then because I need to calm down, I'll be drinking lots of alcohol and smoking, and so you get caught in this vicious cycle. Try to adjust that, eating hot foods, wearing sweaty clothes like, you know, nylons, tight-fitting things, that doesn't help. Making sure you create a good environment to sleep. If none of that helps, you can think about, you know, some over-the-counter products. There are phytoestrogens, plant-based estrogen products you can just get without a prescription. But I think a lot of people I know, we've discussed taking estradiol. You can get transdermal estradiol, and Davina McCall did a documentary a couple of years ago now, where she talked about this and what a difference it had made. And what we can see overall is that about half of the women say it really benefited them, but often for short periods of time. And most women don't take it for that long for whatever reason. Sometimes they feel it stops working, or they get a bit spooked because there is slight increased risk for breast cancer. Or they just want to give it a go and you know, see how they fare. And so most women don't take it for that long, maybe a year, maybe a couple of years. But and the question is, you know, does that benefit you? If it does, keep on doing it. You know, if you don't want to go there, there are alternative ways. One of the ways is working, for instance, with your thoughts, how you think about menopause, what it means. And Professor Myra Hunter in London has developed a therapy for this, and also helping you to sleep, so helping to change your thoughts to sleep. And this has been shown to be really, really successful. So there are other ways of doing it.
What is the evidence base like at the moment for all these different options? You know, which ones I'm mostly gonna work? You know, I'm intrigued as to, with so many different options,
yeah,
which one is the best?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on the individual and what works for you. Again, you know, so I think the talk therapy, where you're tackling your thoughts, you can do that in a group. You can also do it by yourself with booklets. Professor Hunter has got a lot of resources out there. it's called CBT, so cognitive behavioral therapy for these symptoms. And that works really well. It works to improve sleep and people feel less bothered by the flushes. That's been shown. Other types of therapies, maybe not so much, because for instance, what I was interested in, the memory improvement, to then protect against dementia, we found only really works for a couple of months. And then it seems to level off. And as women take it over time for longer than 10 years, it actually starts becoming worse with discontinued therapy.
Interesting. Why? Do we know why that's the case?
There's been some work by Professor Robbie Brinton-Diaz showing that estrogens, if you give them to a healthy cell, they help maintain that cell. But if the cell has damage, which we know is associated with Alzheimer's disease, like the mitochondria, little energy factories don't work so well, or the calcium channels, estrogens will make that worse. So it's a big problem. So it's almost like, and it's the same for heart disease, like atherosclerosis. If you're well, estrogens will help you stay well and healthy. If you're not well, estrogens will make you get worse. So, yeah.
So individuals should probably see a physician to work out.
Absolutely.
The best package.
And you can't, you know, you need to talk and have a good, because there's also risks for breast cancer, for deep vein thrombosis, for stroke. So you, the tiny risks, but endometrial cancer, but you need to sort of make a very good judgment on that, whether you should, you know, go ahead with it or maybe not.
You mentioned about Davina McCall and the documentary, and that was quite big, actually.
Yeah,
and I've seen a lot more in media talking about the menopause. Do you think that's been a good thing in terms of people who actually experience the menopause?
I think it's absolutely great, because a lot of women feel very embarrassed going through menopause and sort of try to hide it. And I think, like at the university, they've been very good about flexible working, you know, if you haven't slept. And sometimes you feel quite overwhelmed going through the menopause. You know, you're having these flushes, mood swings, concentration issues. You can't deal with it. If women are allowed to have a little bit more flexible work, you know, they can deal with it. You can deal with these sorts of symptoms. And again, you know, the vast majority of women won't have objective cognitive impairments. That's a minority. Maybe it's 1 in 5 when they followed women through time. It's predominantly in the transition period. So when the hormones are all over the place, your body and your brain needs time to adapt.
Okay, and I guess raising awareness of it helps people understand that there may be some differences that someone might be experiencing, and understanding can help then allow the person to find support. And that doesn't have to be, you know, official doctor support. It can just be an understanding support, can't it?
I think knowing that you're not alone is a big thing, and that you're not making this up, but this is real. For some women, it's a big, big issue. But it is probably, thankfully, the minority of women. So I don't think, you know, it's quite difficult as a manager to strike a good balance there, where you want to enable women, but you don't want to patronize them by saying, oh, are you going through the menopause then, love, or are you having your period again, darling? You know, I don't think the endocrinology should be used against women. You should work with women. It's like, you know, are you going through the menopause? Is there something I can support you with? You know, I've noticed that, you know, you might be a little bit distracted or unstable, or, you know, well, you might not want to go that far. We're in England after all, but, you know, a little bit more subtle would be good. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm now interested in something that I've heard, I've seen that you've been looking into. So I really want to ask, because it can be a mildly controversial topic, and that's this idea of the andropause, something where men might go through something, question mark, similar to the menopause. Now, tell me, what is the andropause? What do you understand by this?
Well, so this came up again recently because East Midlands Ambulance Service, supposedly, according to the papers, I was giving men a year off for andropause. Everybody was outraged. It was like, how dare they? Now, there is, in men, we see a small decrease in testosterone levels over time, but it's not quite as erratic and dropped, unless these men have their testicles removed for whatever reason, cancer or accident. And then, of course, that drop is huge. And they get massive symptoms. They get very similar symptoms. Also, if men, you know, have chemical castration, if they have prostate cancer, and testosterone is a risk for that, so you want to bring that down and you give them chemicals, they experience very similar symptoms. They get flushes, night sweats, mood instability, brain fog, memory issues. They tend to gain weight, often develop breasts. And of course, this is a huge stigma for men. It's very difficult to deal with. So there is that, but that's a small group of men. Again, it's maybe, you know, between 2-10% of men in midlife who would experience something like that. But if men grow obese in midlife, between the ages of, say, 40 and 60, they have a lower level of free testosterone often. And especially if they drink alcohol, a lot of alcohol, and they smoke, and a lot of stress, that can affect testosterone levels as well. Now, little activity. And of course, it can affect your mood and your memory. So you want to make sure, again, for men, that you keep on exercising. A lot of men and women in the middle age, in midlife, they are very busy, very stressed. You've got the kids who all hate you, your teenagers slamming doors, you've got parents suddenly getting ill, you've got friends perhaps passing away. It's quite a stressful time in life. And there's lots of demands. Plus, work-wise, you're usually at the top of your career. Now, if you then, most people stop exercising then, and they start then eating junk food and start expanding. And that affects your hormone levels. It affects all your hormones, and it will affect your mood and your brain function. We know it does. So these types of behaviors do affect your brain and affect your risk for heart disease, of course, but also dementia later on.
I'm interested in what the pros and cons are of calling it a name which is very similar to the menopause and could be seen as the opposite side of the same coin, mm-hmm. when actually for the majority of men, from what you were saying, this isn't necessarily a big biological change over time, but for women, for the majority, it is about a significant biological change interacting with society. Do you think it's helpful to have the terms quite similar when they've got a different, almost causal reason why they come about?
Yeah, I think it takes away a little bit from the menopause as a topic. But on the other hand, I'm quite happy that it came up. We wrote a piece about this for the conversation. Because in midlife, this is when most of the suicides in men occur. It's an incredibly serious issue, and I don't think enough attention has been given to it. And in fact, when I probed into what the East Midlands Ambulance Service had said, was that if men have mental health issues or physical issues, we will look at that on a case-by-case basis and give them up to a year off if they need to, because that's a statutory right. You know, if you're ill, if you can't work anymore, you need that break, then you should be given that, not because of the menopause, but because of the strains on people in midlife. And I think whereas women are quite good in talking to other women, other men, seeking support, men don't, and a lot of men end up drinking or in the very worst case scenario, committing suicide. And this is perhaps even worse, but very poorly investigated in minority groups and in LGBT, where we know from some studies that this is significantly worse. It's a very, very difficult period in life for some people. And people need support with that. So whatever we call it, it is a vulnerable period, I think, in life.
Yeah, and I can see that instead of terming the concept a midlife crisis, automatically negative association. Yeah. You're potentially doing something wrong, whereas couching it in something else, andropause, or maybe, I don't know, there's another term that we come up with at any point, but somewhat more positive or framed differently at least. Which is good.
Yeah, I think midlife crisis, that's actually relatively rare where you see that massive drop overall. That occurs in some people, but definitely not in all. And I don't think, it's got this sort of image of people suddenly buying a Porsche. So I think it is a big issue. The problem with it is if it only were a crisis, but in the vast majority, there's just very many people desperately unhappy and drinking too much and getting more and more unhealthy and not sleeping and being stressed. And if we look at some countries like Sweden, for instance, where they said, well, people who are middle-aged should really only work part-time because they've got the experience and they can work faster, they don't need to work full-time, and it's much better, they're much more productive. So that I think that would help both men and women.
Yeah, we do, I think. There's still so much of a stigma, I guess, about these two subjects. And I know sometimes the word stigma can be thrown about for various different things. But do you still think there is in the workplace in the UK? Because we see in other places, you just mentioned Sweden, different work-life balance, from what I read anyway.
Yes,
I think we have a very different one in the UK. Mm. Is there something we need to do to change this, to help people in their middle age dealing with all of these issues coming up?
I think we need to look at that from childhood, like most things really. If we look at the students now, especially people who've gone through COVID, being isolated at home, they've had a knock. It hasn't done them, a lot of them, any favours. Being isolated and just and only focused on academic achievement. And I think, the English could learn a lot from Scandinavian countries where it is about family, it's about, having fun with each other, coming home and relaxing, and not this, we need to keep on working, mommy needs to work late, daddy isn't coming home tonight because he's working overtime, you need to get the highest grades possible. There is very much that achievement. And I think by teaching people that, they need to invest in social capital. We could solve a lot of problems, like social isolation is huge in young people and old people and is associated with a lot of mental health. Stresses. So yeah, we need to have a bit of a revamp, I think, of our values. But
we could get there at some point. You never know. It could be valued. The work-life balance. There's the idea of the four-day week that we'd see trialing in places. I've got hope. But do you think for women in particular? We try to ask some tough questions on this podcast and. A lot of the time, we see there are a lot of biases against women in the workplace, still in 2023, whether that's based on a pay gap or treatment or promotions. Do you think the menopause adds another thing? So actually, the menopause and women at work is going to be harder than the andropause and men at work?
I think we need to look at it. If we take a little bit of a step back, we see that the most severe mental health issues and physical health issues are associated with low socioeconomic status, so poor people. And we're seeing an increasing gap between the rich and the poor. And this is a major issue. This is an issue that needs to be tackled because if people, it's all right for the likes of us where we're sitting here quite comfortably and discussing this. Those people who come to my public lectures about, prevention of dementia and heart disease, they're already doing everything they need to do. But they also have, the exercising diet, etc., and not stressing. But they also have the money to do this. If you can't heat your home or you can't get a good diet because you can't afford it, all of this is null and void, and you're stressed because you can't maintain a normal quality of life. So. And this is a growing issue in the UK. It's a very scary issue. It's almost back to Victorian times in that way. And I think that, and we know that that's associated with an earlier age of onset of menopause, with surgery to induce early menopause in women.
That's a bit, that's scary, that. And
it is.
I think with, we're sitting here and talking at the back end of 2023 about this, and the UK has difficulties with its economic growth as well, and productivity, and there can be quite a lot of pressure to get more out of the same number of people that we have. And so those pressures are just continuing all the way through your working life. And then if you have other things biological that are happening as well as your life situation, all of that leads to a difficult melting pot, I can imagine.
Yeah, it is. And it's very difficult to see where an intervention would need to lie. I think, you know, whether it's a political or biological or psychosocial, you know, change, I think it's probably all of those combined, you know, where we need to facilitate healthy lifestyles, you know, to reduce mental health issues.
So tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing in this area now. You know, what are you and your team looking at the moment?
Well, so we're doing a lot of work with the menopause. We're looking at new therapies, working with women, because women told us they want to learn more about this talk therapy, about exercise and diet, and also working with body image, for instance, body image changes over the lifespan. I think what needs to happen in particular is we need to look at how this is for LGBT, especially for trans people. There has been very little research in that. One of the problems being that there are not enough numbers, so we're trying to really look into this, asking people, targeting people for this type of research, because we don't really know enough about it, how that is experienced. If somebody has transitioned from male to female and then needs to stop, for instance, taking hormones, perhaps because of development of cysts, which is risk cancer, risk for breast cancer, how does that feel? Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden, you know, your body starts changing again and you're going through menopause. So it's quite devastating. Are GPs really clued into this? I don't know.
So that's where it needs to... Is that where you need, think it also needs to go next? Is there anything more broad rather than just that, you know, the particular important minority community?
Well, I think we're really interested in minorities. I'm working with also with black women. We are working together with black GPs, for instance, because symptoms seem to be much worse in black women, and they're less likely to take HRT or to be prescribed HRT. But on a wider level, I think our work in promoting our exercise programs, we're doing programs looking at keeping people with dementia, enabling them to drive. We are doing work in Indonesia, looking at early life interventions, making exercise fun for kids, you know, trying to go from a grassroots.
A preventative sort of approach.
Preventative approach,
Sounds very exciting. Where can people go to actually see, you know, what you're doing, the output of it, and anything in the future? Where can they find you?
There are lots of resources on the web. We've got a dementia website, and there's some linked resources, for instance, to the exercises people can do, some of the diets we found that are protective, like Mediterranean diet, some of the very plant-rich soy-based diets in the Southeast Asian region. And we have evidence that that works, and again, improves your memory. They're very easy recipes to do, so you don't need to get any fancy things. Most of it you can just get in most of the shops. So we've got that. There is a menopause website as well to illustrate all the work that we're doing, because there's a lot of very important work done by Dr. Emma O'Donnell, who looks at cardiovascular disease, so heart disease and menopause. Professor Rebecca Hardy looking at social inequality, Professor Amanda Daly looking at sort of what exercise works for the menopause. So there's various people, Professor Fermata Munir looking at cancer and menopause, breast cancer and menopause. So there's lots of people here looking at that who have interesting resources. Professor Munir developed a resource for women to go back to work after breast cancer. I do a lot of public lectures. And there is one from Alzheimer's Research UK, where we're part of the Midlands Steering Group, where we outline most of this work for the public, and it's online available via Alzheimer's Research UK.
And then there's always the Loughborough University website for you to, you know, if you want to get in contact with you as well, which is, you know, I'm sure you'll be open to hearing from there.
Oh, absolutely.
Until you get millions of people messaging and we'll cross that bridge. For the time being, one of the standard questions we ask our guests is, if you were to sell your area of academic expertise, your area of interest to the next generation of curious minds, what would you say to them? How would you sell what you've done and what you do?
I'm always just really surprised anybody pays me for the work I like. So, doing what I do, I really love. And that depends a little bit on the individual, I guess. Years ago, I had a student who wanted to do a PhD, so to become a doctor, which you need to do before you can become a lecturer, senior lecturer, professor, what have you. And he said, Eve, I hate reading. I absolutely abhor statistical analysis, and I definitely find writing awful. And I said, well, that's a PhD. So if you don't like that, then you can't do what I do. But there are so many perks of the jobs of working with young people and often amazing minds and come up with fantastic ideas. That is a lot of fun. But also traveling. You get to do a lot of traveling, either for research or to give lectures at conferences. I've been really fortunate to have been invited all over the world, from Buenos Aires to Japan to Australia to, you know, the US. So I've seen all corners of the world. With to present my work, both to the public but also to a big scientific community.
Sounds a good sell.
And
you get to come on a podcast like this.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, that was fun.
It's been
really
good. And thank you very much for tuning in. If you've liked the episode, then feel free to subscribe to the podcast, and you can do that on the platform of your choice. You can also check out our other podcast, Experts in Sport, as well. And you can find a link to that in the show notes. So that just leaves me to say thank you once again for tuning in, and I look forward to welcoming you back to another health-related podcast in a future episode. Bye-bye for now.